From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peak. Our next guest is Neil deGrasse Tyson, who, along with James Treffel, has written Cosmic Queries, Star Talk's Guide to Who We Are, How We Got Here, and Where We Are Going. Building on the wisdom of the ancients and explaining the most significant science of today, Tyson takes readers on an intriguing journey from past to future, punctuated with stunning images portraying not only the universe, but also the key ideas that help us to understand it. Neil deGrasse Tyson, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. And all science is cool, so that's the best show name there ever was.
Oh, well, it's great to have you back. You know, there's a number of elements to this book that I enjoyed, but one of them is how the book is structured. The cosmos presents so many questions to us, and this book is so easy to navigate to find those answers. For our listeners, tell us how you organized this book.
Yeah, so what we did was, by the way, my podcast, Star Talk, has a highly successful, one of its formats is called Cosmic Queries, where we're not interviewing guests or anything. It's just the fan base asking questions back into the show. Mm-hmm. And so it's not us prejudging what it is that you're curious about. It's the fulfillment of your own curiosity brought into the studio. And maybe the success of that format is simply because people then become a participant rather than a listener. You would even happen vicariously, right? So even if it's not your question getting answered, it's someone out there with you who got to ask their question. And there's some of those questions that were just so deep that they didn't lend themselves to an easy podcast response. And we collected them and we realized these are repeating deep questions. And so we made a book of 10 chapters, each one with some of the most profound inquiries we have ever thought to bring upon ourselves throughout the history of civilization. How did it all begin? How will it all end? Is there life in the universe? Is there, what are we made of? How did the universe get to be this way? And these are questions that don't lend themselves to wiki page answers. They touch on the philosophical, some might even say spiritual, and I was delighted to feed this undeniable hunger that so many people have retained into adulthood. It's really curiosity, really, coupled with wonder. And that's a potent twin engine of exploration. And so that's what it is. It's a celebration of the question as well as our efforts to answer them.
I looked at it as a love letter to the cosmos.
Oh, good. I like that.
And so the illustrations were really helpful to me in trying to grog and understand some of this. I wanted to ask you, your undergraduate was at Harvard University. Did you know Dr. Eric Chazon from?
Oh, yeah, of course. Physics? Oh, yeah.
Okay, so he was my professor as well. And we went out for a beer after class one night.
At Harvard?
At Harvard, yeah.
Because he would later move to Tufts. That's why.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we went out for a beer afterwards. And he said, anytime we're having a heady conversation, let's say it's an astrophysicist, a mathematician, and a microbiologist, I'll ask my wife to join us. She's an artist. And she starts sketching while they're talking. And he felt that the illustrations and the artistic input really help them frame their questions and what their possible answers might be. So I really enjoyed the illustrations that you had.
Well, yeah. So in the book, I was at a third maybe of all of the photos are not photos, they're artwork that evokes the theme of what you're moving through. So yeah, I've always been a fan of art or the efforts of artists to try to capture a version of reality that I think can engage your emotions in ways that are not otherwise typical.
Right.
And and what is wonder if not emotion, right? If you look at Van Gogh's Starry Night, one of the most famous paintings in the modern repertoire, is clearly that's not what he saw, but it surely is what he felt. And I enjoy probing the impact that knowledge of the universe has on how you feel and how you think and how you live. So many of these discoveries that have taken place over the millennia had the power to impact us in just those ways. And so in that way, the science became a fundamental part of the human condition, beyond just the technology that's obvious, became a part of our sense of ourselves and our place in the universe.
Very good.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's joining us to talk about his newest book, Cosmic Queries, StarTalk's Guide to Who We Are, How We Got Here, and Where We're Going. Neil, I'm wondering if the sort of intersectionality of, you know, what you're talking about with, it's not just science, it's, you know, a philosophical look at things, it's a spiritual look at things, it's the way we perceive the world. As we sort of bring these together, and I feel like that's what your job is, that's what keeps you coming on shows like this and Colbert and, you know, CBS Morning News, instead of hanging out in your lab like you say you'd like to, but is it so that you're bringing all this together to teach us, in essence, how to keep that sense of wonder and how to bring back that sense of curiosity that we may have lost?
Yeah. So first, let me applaud your recognition that we all at some point in our lives had a deep sense of curiosity and wonder traceable to childhood, and that not everyone retains it as we get older. We get more encrusted, more ossified. We just simply lose the curiosity. And I'm happy to report that I still catch snowflakes in my mouth as I walk down the street if they've fallen slow. And I don't ever want to lose that because that's just a fun kid thing to do. I jump in puddles. I spin on the boardroom chairs just because that's fun. You're not supposed to, because everybody there is an important person making important decisions about important companies or agencies. But I just get in there and I spin. So yes, I think childhood curiosity is something deeply, in fact, is crucial to what drives people to explore. And curiosity and wonder, right, the twin engines of exploration, are what really keeps this going. And why do I do it? I think that's part of what's in your question as well. I would, most of the times, I'd rather just be in the lab. But then I realize there people could benefit from having some sense of scientific curiosity so that they can anchor their decisions on what is objectively true in the world rather than on wishful thinking or magical thinking, or particularly if you're about to write legislation or laws, you want that anchored in something that doesn't issue forth from a belief system that is not shared by everyone. So I feel a sense of duty to then bring it to the public. And if the public didn't need it, I'd just stay home. I'd be fine. I have no hesitation staying home for that.
I remember as a little girl, there were so many scientific sort of theories that I had about space and about our place in the universe. And it makes me wonder, and at some point those things, I stopped thinking about those things, but I remember at one point thinking I could see molecules and how cool that was, and thought about a colony on the moon.
That's when the Russians grabbed a hold of you. And,
but it makes me wonder, because you interact with so many young people and also so many adults, the types of queries that you get, the questions from young people, what do they have that we don't, that our questions as adults don't possess?
Well, that's a brilliant and insightful question. And there is a difference I never really thought about until just now that you uttered that question. So here's the difference. Kids will ask a question because they're genuinely curious. And I'm stereotyping here, of course, and there are exceptions, but whereas an adult will ask a question because they want an answer that will continue to feed what they want to be true about the world. So the adult is looking for affirmation of what they already think is true, Whereas the child has no preconcept of what is true, and it's just an open book, ready to have written in it whatever comes, without any attempt to reshape it, to put it through a filter, or have it be viewed through some kind of lens. So that's a difference. And I guess you can't blame adults. We have to, in making sense of the world, we have to arrive at some habits. We have to, it's easier to just do what someone says or what your party tells you to do than to think it through on your own. It's just easier. And we're, I think as a species, we're fundamentally lazy. So it's harder to say, why do they want me to think this way? Maybe there's another way to think. Is there a reason for thinking this way? Is there a force operating that is not genuine, that actually has ulterior motives? This level of questioning takes energy and time and commitment. And if you're not ready to do that, then you're just looking for affirmations of everything you're already doing. And that's sad, but I'm can handle it, I think. I'm ready for it when it arises. And so, yeah, that's the difference.
So it used to be.
And also, kids don't ask about their horoscope. They still think they're in control of the world. And only adults, when they're taught by other people that maybe you're not in control of the world and the planets and their alignment. And so then they start reading horoscopes. So the curiosity of the child is just so pure, and it's uncontaminated by prior belief systems, that it's a delight to have conversations with them.
Well, it used to be that a science writer or a scientist would put together a piece. They'd do diligence, make sure it was right. They may show it to some peers. They have an editor, a publisher, maybe a fact checker involved. Now anybody can post anything to the web. How do we teach our kids to understand the truth, to ask the right questions, maybe boost or increase the probability of getting to the truth?
I have, from what I have come to learn in the last 2 years, primarily from my kids, one is age 24, the other 20, so they're not kids anymore. But what I learned from them and from reading news analysis is that that next generation are not the ones being duped by the internet. It's the older generations, from millennials on up, who are completely sucked into the black holes of the business model for Facebook and YouTube, and you can't climb back out of it. You're just fed things that continue to drive your urges and your hatreds and your tribalism. And that next generation is far less susceptible to it than we are. And if you look at the people who most believed in Pizzagate and all of this other stuff, it's older people, it's not the youngest generation. It's just not. So I'm not here to tell you, let's worry about the next generation. I can't wait till they take over so they can fix all the problems that we created.
Yeah, and I hope you're right. You know, that old story, you know, a guy wears boxer shorts because his father will wear boxer shorts, or, you know, so these parents have a lot of influence over these kids.
No, that less, because the parents are not as internet savvy as the next generation is. You should take a look at the numbers on that. It's why the next generation is so progressive in their views. Mm-hmm. If only people 30 and under ever voted, Trump would have never become president. Right. So it's so if you look at the demographic shift into the younger generation, no, they're not being influenced by their parents. Their parents are freaking clueless about what all the forces that are operating, and they're really victims of it, really. And the next generation, they have, there's internet training in school, how to look for it, what not to trust. What you should be more likely to trust. So no, I don't agree with you. And I think if you looked at the data that's gathered by Pew and others, you won't find it that way. So no, I can't wait till that next generation takes over, because they're in a position to fix everything from global climate change to the energy problem to the pollution problem. They are at the front lines of that. Not anyone from your and my generation. How old is Greta Thurbton? You know, is she 18 yet? Okay.
Yeah.
At tops? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty exciting. Hey,
Perseverance team's doing a pretty good job calibrating their instrumentation package. They got the wind sensor going today, or they've got it in the position anyway. And I understand that they're going to start working on finding a suitable place for Ingenuity, the helicopter, to take off. What will that device do for us?
Nothing. It's an engineering test, and it'll be the first airborne navigating object ever on another planet. So there's a lot of engineering that needs to be resolved. I think it has a good camera on it, so you get some aerial views. But think of a subsequent rover that carries a next generation helicopter. You can then, you're not going to take a rover over a cliff face, right? Or over a sharp crater rim, but you can definitely take a drone copter up and down in and then back out again, going places where no rover has gone before. So I have very high hopes for what can be demonstrated in this round in anticipation of the next rover that goes to Mars, as every rover has been going back to the first ones, right? And even the first landers, each one is an improvement on the next, where we've refined our questions, ultimately refining our answers.
Our guest is Neil deGrasse Tyson. Neil, it was, well, on the day of the when Perseverance landed on Mars, you know, JW and I are texting each other back and forth, and we're really excited. It's the one thing I've kind of shared on my Facebook page for months. We're excited, and I can only imagine how excited you were, he who gathers snowflakes on his tongue and jumps in mud puddles and is an astrophysicist. And then the next weekend, I was listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. I'm sure you know that.
I was on it a couple of times. I did miserably, by the way.
Okay. Well, they were saying things, they were being funny, but they were talking about how boring it really all is. And they said things like, oh, you know, the wind on Mars, we got to listen to the wind on Mars. Wasn't that boring? It sounded just like wind anywhere. And aren't these photos, you know, boring? And I started to think about how, yeah, I guess some people would regard it in that way, but we shouldn't. And why is that? I mean, why should we think that space exploration is important for what we are doing here on Earth?
Yeah, I don't try to require that people feel the same way about space as I do. In a free country, think whatever you want, okay? But while you're thinking whatever you want, at least make sure it's an informed posture. Otherwise, you're not doing due diligence for the intelligence that we have as humans. So your opinion should be intelligently constructed rather than constructed out of blind ignorance. That's my first comment. Second, the robots on Mars, given sensory capacities that we would take with us if we went ourselves, like listening to the wind, viewing, watching the descent, improves the, it further establishes the rover as an extension, as a robotic emissary of we humans. By loading it up with these sensory factors, which when brought back to Earth, you can say, I feel like I was there. That's important because NASA is tax-based funded. And so if you can bring in people to participate in that landing, that's almost an obligation of a tax-based funded agency. And I think that NASA is doing it marvelously. Now, if you don't happen to be interested in it, okay. I bet you weren't interested in the first satellite. You can't even see it. Or a set of satellites launched by the military. I'm not interested in that. I don't even want to pay for it. But back in the late 1980s and early 1990s, oh my gosh, it completely enables the business model of Uber and all map making agencies. It enables that. And if you add up the value of GPS industry, okay, the global positioning system of satellites, a military project initially, oh, but I don't like space. I don't want space. Oh my gosh. How else do you get packages delivered tomorrow that you ordered this afternoon? All right. The coordinate system that enables that, that empowers it. And on the other end of that, you can swipe left or right. That sequence is sending a signal up to a satellite to find your mate within some radius that you have established. Oh my gosh. So here's what I will tell you. If we all, let's go back 30,000 years and we're in a cave, all right? And someone, and you, okay, you pry open the cave door and you see like meadows and flowers and trees and fruit on the trees and a mountain and a stream. And then you go back into the cave and say, I want to explore that. And the people in the cave are saying, no, we have cave problems that we have to solve first. We don't have the luxury to leave the cave. Let's just solve that first, then you can go out and explore. So that's a completely ridiculous command given to someone who just wants to see what else is out there outside of the cave. So yeah, so maybe the wind doesn't excite you or anything else, but the fact that we are in space has transformed your life, whether you know it or not. And the transformations are things that if I went in the dark of night and removed all the space-enabled technology that you depend on, and you woke up the next morning, you won't know where the hurricane is, where it's coming. You won't have 5 days of weather in advance. You will feel intellectually and technologically impoverished. And so, yeah, you don't have to like the wind. I do. I'm there. But I know you like practically everything else that space has brought us. And if you don't know it, we need an ad agency to let you know.
Yeah. Well, hey, next time you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, I want you to tell them how they offended us.
I was only on there once. And don't they, doesn't the crew rotate often? Is Paula Poundstone still there?
I don't think so.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know if next time I'm on, it's all the same people. They say, it wasn't our fault.
You know, we only have a couple of minutes left. I was thinking about something. There's certainly a lot of talk about this Goldilocks zone, which is based on our Earth's distance from our sun. And I was curious, when we go out looking for exoplanets, do we take into consideration the size of the star that is part of their system and how close they are, how close that exoplanet may be to their atmosphere?
It's multifaceted. So the Kepler mission focused on Earth-like stars, it looked for Earth-like planets around sun-like stars. Mm-hmm. So you can say, well, that's a profound bias. Maybe there's life on non-Earth-like planets orbiting non-sun-like stars. Sure, but you got to start somewhere. And you start with what you know. And we do have evidence of life on an Earth-like planet orbiting an Earth-like sun. It's called Earth, right? So you start with what you know, and then you extend from there. The catalog of planets, exoplanets, is now up above 4,000 and counting. So plus, we know that Jupiter keeps some of its moons warm with the tidal forces that stress it and pump energy into them. And that's way outside of the Goldilocks zone. So the concept of a Goldilocks zone is, it makes for a fundamentally interesting calculation, but we need to completely widen the net if we're going to look for life that thrives in what was originally just this one zone, because you can have sources of heat that are not traceable to the sun that would still work in exactly the same way.
Neil deGrasse Tyson has written Cosmic Queries, Star Talk's Guide to Who We Are, How We Got Here, and Where We Are Going. We both very much enjoyed the book. It's a great reference. And as I mentioned earlier in the interview, it's very easy to navigate. So best of luck with it. And thanks for joining us again on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. And do call again. I mean, you're in the trenches in ways that I'm not. So just keep it going and just holler if you need me.
Sounds good.
Thanks, Neil.
All right, thank guys. You, Neil.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.